as we reflect back on this journey we've made along with Saul and, you know, of course, Samuel and David and all, and if you've been with us or if you studied this before on your own and all, you know how rich it is. And if you haven't studied or you're not familiar with it, you might think, oh man, the Old Testament, you know, just a bunch of history and dry and dusty. I pray you've found that it's just quite the opposite, of course. It is very relevant to where we are today. As we look at Saul and David, and then we see ourselves woven all through it, don't we? We see the gospel all through it. We see the Lord through it. We see ourselves so often in it. It is just such good stuff. I've had the privilege to travel through 1 Samuel, teach 1 Samuel, three or four times or so now. And I just, each time I just find new, all these nuggets laying around, so to speak. Just awesome things. And good stuff. And tonight we just continue on in that study. 1 Samuel, we're in chapter 29. Now, as we come to chapter 29, let's make sure we all are on the same page and kind of make sure where we are in the story here. You remember that David has been on the run from Saul for some time now. Saul is the current king, but God has rejected Saul because Saul had rejected the word of the Lord. And David's going to be the new king, but right now Saul is still on the throne, and Saul has really got himself in bad shape. He is a jealous, paranoid man, and he's out to get David. Well, David, because of fear of Saul, has actually fled and gone over to the Philistines area. The Philistines, of course, are enemies of the Israelites, but David, in trying to deal with his fears and all, and trying to deal with what's going on here with Saul, he flees to the area of the Philistines. And he goes there to the king of the Philistines, whose name is Achish. And he seeks of Achish a place to live, and Achish gives David and David's men a city called Ziklag. I know it looks like Ziklag, and you'll probably hear me saying it Ziklag several times, but my understanding is it's Ziklag. But I don't know how well I can say that each time. But anyway, he gets the city, this village to live in. And while he's there, while David is living amongst the Philistines, David goes out and begins to raid various areas down south there in the Philistines' territory. But when he comes back, when Achish asks David where you've been, David would say, oh, I've been in to raid the Israelites. I've been over, you know, plundering the land of Judah and all. That's not true. It's a lie. He's been out actually killing friends and all and neighbors of the Philistines. But he tells the Philistine king that he's out getting the Israelites, his own people. Well, the Philistine king, Achish, he loves that. Really, that really endears David to the Philistine king because he's thinking, wow, his own people are going to hate him now. Certainly he'll serve me because his own people are going to really be down on him because he's plundering them. But that, of course, is a lie. He's not doing that. To cover that up, David kills every man, woman, and child of every village he does plunder so they won't come and tell the truth that David is out killing actually these other people, not the Israelites. So we see David basically, fear has gotten in the driver's seat. He's gone to dwell amongst his enemies. That's led him to lie and compromise. He's a man that's just, he's in a rough place. As we come to chapter 29, the Philistines actually now gather to attack the Israelites. So David is living with the Philistines, and the Philistines are getting ready to attack the Israelites. So David is potentially in the position now of having to attack his own people. The people God has called him to be king over, his very own people, he potentially is in a position where he's going to have to fight them. It'll turn out he won't have to through God's deliverance and all here, but he's in that position. All this is to say that we're in a time right now, as we begin chapter 29, we're in a time of David's life that is definitely not one of his high points. Again, it's a time of fear and doubt controlling him. He's lying to protect himself. He's not trusting God at this point. It's a very low point. He has drifted a long ways from where he was and where he needs to be. He's taking matters into his own hands. And that's not a wise move, of course, on David's part or any of our part. So now we join him as the Philistines are preparing to attack Israel. Verse 1. Then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands. But David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. Then the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? and to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. So the princes of the Philistines said to him, make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him. And do not let him go down with us to the battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his ten thousands? So as we begin here, they're getting ready for battle, and they're all passing in review, and then at the very end, here comes David and his men with the king, and the Philistine princes see that, and they go, hold it. They go, why are these Hebrews here? We're getting ready to fight the Hebrews. Why are they part of us? And the king goes to bat for him and says, wait a minute, this is David. He's defected to us. He's been serving us all along. He's one of us now, and haven't found any fault in him at all. And so the king's saying he should go fight with us. But the princes aren't buying it. They're angry with Achish for suggesting this, and they tell him, send David home. They don't want David, because, and they say here, I mean, what better way could David get himself back in well with his people and all than in the middle of the battle turn around and start killing us? And we don't want the Israelites over here and David and his men over here, and all of a sudden they got the enemy all around us here. And they go, this is the same David that they used to sing, David has killed his ten thousands. And when they sang that, he was talking about us. That's what the Philistines would say. He slayed 10,000 of us. And we don't need him fighting on our side, because he could very well turn around and start killing us. And so they won't go out to battle with him around there. So they say, send him home. Verse 6. Then Achish called David and said to him, surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright. And you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favor you. Therefore, return now and go in peace, that you may not displease the Lord to the Philistine. So Achish has to go to David and say, well, David, I know you've been a good guy. Now, David has Achish totally deceived. Achish believes that David's a good guy. He doesn't know David's been lying to him and everything else. And he goes, you've been good on my side. I haven't found any fault in you. But nevertheless, the other guys here in the battle don't want you around. They say you can't be part of this. So, you know, just please understand, but, you know, go in peace, but you're going to have to go back home. Verse 8. So David said to Achish, what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant, as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Think what David's saying right there. Now is he, I don't know, he says, well, wait, but what have I done? Haven't I really been great? Haven't I been your servant and all? How come I can't go and fight against your enemies? Who's he talking about? The Israelites. He's pleading his case with his enemy to be able to let the enemy join him to go fight against his own people. Interesting. Then Achish answered and said to David, I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. Now therefore, rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you. And as soon as you are up early in the morning and have light, depart. So David and his men rose early to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. In these verses here, David actually says here that he's ready to go fight against his own people, and he's pitching his case, saying, wait a minute, I've been a good guy to you. Again, Achish is totally deceived. He tells David, you're as good as an angel of God, because he believes what David's been telling him. He doesn't know. There's been lying and all deceiving going on. But David says he'll go fight. He wants to go fight against these enemies of my lord the king, Achish. Again, a very sad place that David has arrived at. His fear brought him into the enemy's camp. Once there, he began to lie and deceive to maintain a relationship there. And now he actually says he will fight against Israel, his own people. When David first reflected upon his situation with Saul a couple of chapters ago and said, you know, Saul's going to kill me one of these days. I got to get out of here. And he decided to flee to the enemy's camp. David, of course, didn't know the events that would unfold. Only God knows the future. And I don't know if David understood what he was going to be beginning here, but you know, it's an interesting thing. When you begin to make this kind of decision, it's interesting to watch the dominoes begin to fall in our life. a compromise here. You know, we give in there. I don't need to do that. I can skip that. We begin to get in the world's way and do it the world's way and handle things the old way. And all of a sudden we find ourselves cutting a corner or compromising or telling a little white lie or a fib, whatever that is a lie. But we do that, and all of a sudden down and down and down we go. And as we see David here going down and down and down. And now he finds himself. And what a sad place. This is the called, anointed king of Israel. He hasn't ascended to the throne yet. Saul is still on the throne. There's a transition going on. But God, a while back, sent Samuel to show that David is going to be the next king. And there was an anointing that took place. And Lord willing, next week we'll see him become a king of Judah. But look where it's gotten him. What an interesting, sad place to find the next king of Israel. No one is impervious to stumbling and backsliding. We all have to be careful. But here he is in a situation. Now, was David really going to attack the Israel? If Achish and the princes said, okay, go ahead and fight with us, was David really going to attack his own people? Is David just kind of putting up a ruse here? Does he see that things are going to go pretty well? He's going to get out of this. God's delivering him, really, in the end, because God, of course, does or allows all things that come along. And you know, when he goes, why? What have I done? Haven't I been good? Let me go fight with you. Is he doing that as a kind of ruse to show that, you know, to keep up this image with the king, knowing that he's not going to be able to go, the princes aren't going to buy it? Would he have really fought against his own people? We don't know. We can speculate, but we don't know, because God does deliver him from it. So Achish has David leave. He and his men leave, and they do so. They get up early in the morning, and they head back to Ziklag with his men. Chapter 30. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, and Ziklag attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire. And had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So while he is going through this time of acting like he would go to battle with the Philistines, but then being turned away, when he's in this place of compromising and lying and not walking with the Lord and all, not seeking the Lord and just doing things his own way, you would think that's about as low as it can get, but here we see the bottom of the barrel coming up quick. Because he gets back to his village, and while he's been gone, we find the Amalekites have attacked. If you can kind of picture a map of Israel today, the place where the Philistines had gathered was in Aphek, and it's kind of in the middle of the country to the west, to the left of Jerusalem, towards the coast over there. Whereas Ziklag is further down south, the Philistine territory and all is further down south, and Ziklag was further down south. So the armies are getting ready to go north and do battle. They've gathered in this one area. Well, he goes back down south, kind of southwest of Jerusalem, to back to Ziklag. Now, while he was there at this Philistines, the Amalekites, another group of people, had come into the southern area and attacked and burned the area. We're going to see in a moment here that it's not just the Philistine area, but they had penetrated into the area of Judah also. But they had raided and attacked, and part of that was they had come into and attacked and burned down Ziklag and taken the children and women and all as captive, probably, of course, to use them as slaves or to sell them as slave trade and all. But here we see that. And it's interesting. It says it's the Amalekites. Now, remember who the Amalekites are. When the children of Israel were in bondage way back when they were in Egypt, and God delivered them out of Egypt and was bringing them to the land that God had for them in Canaan here, as they were making their way, the Amalekites were the people who would attack this large caravan of the Israelites as the Hebrew people were making their way from Egypt into the promised land. The Amalekites would come down and attack the big, long caravan. But they wouldn't attack what you might say, if there's such a thing as attacking in an honorable way, you know, kind of coming against the strong part. They would hold back. When you have a long caravan of women and children and people who are sick and elderly people. As you're traveling along, you're going to be spread out for a long way. And those who tend to be weaker, who are sicker, whatever reasons, the elderly, they would tend, of course, to straggle towards the rear. That's who the Amalekites would attack. They would swoop down on the rear of the caravan and attack the vulnerable, the weak. And that's what the Amalekites were like. It's interesting. God noted that. And it said the day would come when he would get even, so to speak. He would get revenge upon them for doing that to the children of Israel. That led to the occasion, one of Saul's great downfall, didn't it? Because the time came a while back, a number of chapters ago, where God said, okay, Saul, it's time to go get the Amalekites. I want you to go get the Amalekites for what they did to you as you made your way here. And when you go there, I want you to destroy all of them and all their flocks and all. There'll be other times of raiding where you'll be able to keep things, but this time you're to kill everything. Because God was inflicting a judgment, a punishment upon these Amalekites. They were wicked people. But we saw Saul didn't do it. He didn't completely destroy the Amalekites. And that will come back to haunt them, so to speak, a number of times. He did not utterly destroy them as God told them to. You see, in Scripture, you'll find commentators often point out the fact that the Amalekites are an example. They're sometimes pointed to as an example or representative of the flesh, the battle that we have with the flesh. And you'll see commentators refer to that, and they become a very good example of that. God's remedy, of course, for us is to destroy the flesh, to reckon it dead, to not let it have the driver's seat, so to speak. Our flesh, those desires and all, must be brought to the cross. They must be brought under God's control. We must reckon the old man, the flesh, the old nature, dead. We're not to let it live, so to speak. We're not to make provision for the flesh. And when Saul did not kill all the Amalekites, it becomes an example of us allowing parts of our flesh to survive and thrive and to dictate and control and to have the driver's seat. And just as the Amalekites will continue to plague Israel, our flesh will always continue to plague us if we don't learn the discipline of yielding to the Spirit. Paul said, the flesh wars against the Spirit and the Spirit against the flesh. While we're in this body, there will be a battle going on. But he tells us the answer is to do just that, to walk in the Spirit that we don't fulfill the lust of the flesh, to continually make sure the Spirit is in the driver's seat. And the Amalekites become an example of that in Scripture, of what happens when you allow for and don't deal with that part of our lives. So now we see the Amalekites have been raiding the area, and they raid Ziklag, and they take the women and children with them. And David arrives, and he finds this out. Verse 3. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David arrives home now, and things have gone from bad to worse. He's living in the enemy's territory. He's been lying and compromising. But now we begin to see the fruits of all that. And here his family's all been left unprotected, and they've been raided and taken captive and all. And it says he and his men see this. And these are not wimps. These are guys these are David and his valiant men, and they have fought some awesome battles, and they've been through some rough times, and they've been hiding in caves and running across the wilderness and everything else. But they see this, and it just kind of, it's like it's the straw that breaks the camel's back for his men, and they begin to cry. And it says that David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices, wept until they had no more power to weep. Now I want to ask you to raise your hand. Have you ever been there? You ever been a time you just cried, you just till you cried just dry, the tear ducts just ran empty. You just cried and cried till you just felt like you were wrung out. And those aren't fun times. But God is getting their attention. But they cry until so they have no more power to weep. They've had it. They're exhausted. And now they just have no more tears to cry. And so they sit there. But their grief leads them to begin to pick up stones now, and they begin to speak of stoning him. And that greatly distresses David. These guys had been with him through thick and thin, but now this is too much. This is too much, and they want to stone him for it. But the end of verse 6, we looked at this morning. It was our focus verse. I encourage you to get that tape if you weren't able to be a part of it, because there's so much here, and we can just lightly touch on it tonight. But while David's men speak of stoning him, while their tears drive them to consider killing David, David's tears cause him to look up. And this is David's turning point. We're going to see from here on out, we're going to see a different David. This is nothing short than David's revival. His circumstances lead him to tears, to breaking and all, and that leads him to revival. May God do that in our lives if it needs to be. And may we always be open to that. And that God can quickly bring us back when we wander off. We'll be sensitive to that. But it says here, David strengthened himself in the Lord. David had gone through a period where fear had controlled his decisions, and he had lied and he deceived. But now here we see him turning back. He strengthens himself in the Lord. Verse 7. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. The ephod was a vest type of thing they wore, a garment that the priest wore when they would be seeking the Lord. And verse 8 says, so David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he, the Lord, answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. What an awesome word. What an encouraging word. We see that David's turning here is sincere. We see that his strengthening meant a revival, because the next thing we see is he inquires of the Lord. As I mentioned this morning, it's been a long time since David had done that. We don't read, while he's here with the Philistines and all, of David doing that. We read of him listening to his fears and listening to everything else, but he doesn't seek and listen to the Lord. But now at the bottom of the barrel, he looks up. Barrels have a way of making us look up. If you're in that place, let God do it. Let God use those circumstances to cause you to look up. And he seeks the Lord once again. And that shows us, praise God, things are back on track now for David. He seeks counsel from the Lord. Lord, should I take after these guys? What would you have me do, Lord? Lord says, pursue them, and you will overtake them, and you will recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. So David strengthened himself in the Lord. Everybody else is down on him. They're looking around trying to find blame, trying to cast stones. He looks up, and he once again begins to be refreshed and strengthened in the Lord. And he seeks the Lord. Lord, what would you have me do? And the Lord says, take off. Go after your enemy. Recover what the enemy has taken from you. Let me restore what's been ripped off from you. And I think we understand the spiritual analogy there. I want to restore that which you forfeited. I want to restore what the enemy has ripped you off from. And we're not just talking material things here, of course. But for us, it's the restoration of fellowship and peace and those things the enemy can rip us off from. But he says, do it. And so David does it. We don't read about him debating or saying, well, I don't want to do that. Lord, what would you have? And the Lord tells him, and he acts on it. Another sign of real repentance, another sign of really coming back to the Lord and cooking with the Lord again, is he now starts to do things God's way. Excuse me. The Lord tells David to pursue these Amalekites, and he'll prevail over them. And he heads off, and it says that they get to the brook Besor, and 200 of his 600 men, 200 of the men are too tired. They're just beat. They're spent, and they can't go any further. So he leaves 200 of the men there, and he and 400 men continue to pursue the Amalekites. Verse 11. Then they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they let him drink water. And they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites and the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Now you can bet David's ears right then went, "Boing." Okay, this is what I need to know here. And David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" So he said, "Swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop." So they're chasing the Amalekites. All of a sudden they come across this young man. It turns out to be an Egyptian. Turns out to be a servant of an Amalekite. But they just find him. He's out there. He's been there for 3 days with no food and water. His master was so compassionate and caring that when his servant fell sick, he just said, "Leave him." He left him in the desert. The Amalekites were not nice people. And so they just left him in the desert to die. Well, they come across him and they revive him. They give him water and food and he gets his strength back. And finally, "Well, who are you?" And he tells them, "Well, I'm an Egyptian. I belong to an Amalekite, but I fell sick. We're in this area because we've been raiding the area and we did this and did this. And by the way, we burned Ziklag." And of course, that, as I said, that gets David's attention. He says, "Well, can you take me to him? Can you take me to where they are?" And he goes, "Well, yeah, on the condition of two things. That you don't kill me, you don't give me back to my master." So he now agrees to take David and the men to catch up with the Amalekites. Verse 16. "And when he had brought him down, there they were, spread out over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines, from the land of Judah." So, I mean, David catches up. Now David and his men catch up with the Amalekites. And they are what? They are partying. They're partying on, dude. I mean, let's face it. The Philistines aren't home. They're all up in the north getting ready to attack Israel. We're just raiding, having a great time. Now we're on the way home. We've got all this booty, all these spoils, man. We just got all this stuff. You know, we got animals. And apparently, as you'll see in a moment, it's a great herd of animals and livestock and all they've gotten. And so they're drinking and apparently don't have a guard set out or anything. They're thinking everything's cool. And they're just laying around and all and partying. Verse 17, "Then David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled." David only started with 400. Here it says he gets them all except for just the small remnant, 400 that got away. I don't know how many there were to begin with, but it must have been a very large complement of soldiers, of men here. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything, which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before those other livestock and said, "This is David's spoil." He catches up with the Amalekites, he attacks them, and God gives him a victory. It says he recovers all that was taken, including his wives. He gets back all this other stuff that was taken, all the spoils, all the flocks and all. But of course, there is that spiritual application we need to just remember once again. That in going to the enemy's camp and doing things our own way, we do forfeit so much. We lose so much. The enemy plunders us, so to speak. And there we are without peace, enjoying our lives and all those things he wants to have for us. But if we would just once again, let him revive us. Let him strengthen us. Inquire of him once again and then do whatever he tells us to do. In that moment when we turn back to him, he's not distant. He's right there. And he begins to restore to us the peace and the joy and the things that we've let rip us off. You know, our schedules rip us off. Our this lifestyle around us, if we get into it, can rip us off. The pace of this world can rip us off. There's so many things that can get in the way of that. And it can be subtle at first. Like I said, it's like dominoes that begin to fall. We don't realize it until we're sitting there and things are burned out around us and circumstances are just, you know, we just wonder, how did I get here? What is going on? Well, instead of trying to think it through and strategize it and plot and pull up your bootstraps and give it your best shot and buying the latest self-help book or buying the latest gizmo on TV or something, only one thing restores and strengthens. Only one thing, and that is just that, turning back to Him and letting Him be who He wants to be and all that He can be in our lives. And taking that time for refreshing and strengthening, remembering His goodness towards us, His faithfulness, His promises, all those things about the Lord that He offers to us. You know, I say this here at church, and this is because this is where we gather to hear this, but it's for us to apply out there, right there in the everyday, isn't it? You know, at that place of work or school or home and the stress is on, that's when we need to take time to strengthen ourselves and let this be so real to us, because He's right there with us. He's down. The Lord is as much over at Coco's or something as He is here. The Lord's over there at the yogurt mill, and He's over there at your work, and He's over there at your school, and He's everywhere. And sometimes maybe we feel like we leave here, and okay, I got to get through till next week or something. And He's saying, well, don't do that. Let me strengthen you. Inquire of Me constantly, and then just do what I say. And recover. Recover those things that have been getting ripped off from you. David recovers all. What an awesome thing this is. And we're going to see this is part of a whole series of change of things now as we see David now begin to get back in sync with God and move forward here. Not that he's going to be a perfect man. We know that. But he's learning important lessons here. And here we see him acting on this, the most important one of being strengthened in the Lord. So anyway, David catches up with them and gets this great victory, and he has this spoil, gets all the livestock and all. Verse 21. Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow. Now that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Bezor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, and when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. So basically, what's the idea here? David gets back to where he had to leave the 200 guys behind. He left them with the supplies there and all, and they were tired and couldn't go on. They get there. Well, it says that David has amongst his group a group of guys that says here they are wicked and worthless men, literally men of Belial. Worthless men, not good. Amongst David's valiant men, there were men who apparently were of less than sterling character. David also had to put up with various types of people in various places in their character and all. And they get back there and they go, hey, these guys didn't go out to fight with us, then they don't get any of the spoil. They can have their wives and children back, but let them take their wives and children and leave us and get out of here. Verse 23, but David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was from that day forward. He made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. They say, hey, these guys don't get nothing. They didn't fight with us. All they get is wives and children, but they don't get any of the spoils or anything else. But David is a man after God's heart. And he sees from God's viewpoint. And David says what? No way. No way. He says, we're all in this together. Yes, this particular group of guys were too tired. And yes, they had to stay back here, and they stayed back with the supplies, and they watched over the supplies and all. But those who went will share equally with those who stayed behind. We'll all share alike. And this, as it says, becomes a rule that David established during this time in Israel. What an interesting thing this is to remember. And I guess there are various applications, but one to consider is this. There are those who go off to the battle and those who stay behind by the stuff, by the supplies, as it says here. But it's interesting. David here reflects something that could very well be argued is God's heart, and that is, God says both are going to share in the fruit of the victories. There are those who God calls to go off to a mission field. And when God calls, always, of course, you want to obey. There are those who are the sent. And I think of those who labor in some situation that just, well, most of us can probably relate to. Sean and a couple of the guys here are going to, Tony and Dan are going to join them, and they're going to be heading off to, over to the Sudan. And I suspect they're going to see and hear things and be involved around with, if not see, certainly be real close to some things that you and I can't relate to. I've talked to some guys that have been over there already, and they come back in shell shock sometimes, just the things they've seen. The things that are going on over in the Sudan and those areas. Just there, but we think of something like Nan, who spoke this morning for a little bit. She oversees the rock ministries there in Romania. And when I watch a little bit of those videos of the children there in Romania, I was telling Nan this after second service. I said, I find it very, very hard to watch. The way these little ones are mistreated and just warehoused in situations that we in America almost can't understand. And they're so deprived. No one to hold them or love them. And there they are, old enough they should be progressing along, but they're just all just emaciated and no one to love them. And you just read it and your heart goes out and you go, ah. And I told her, I have trouble watching those videos. But she, of course, rightly said, and we have to concentrate on the victory. What God's done over there. The many, many cases where the children now are receiving love and things are being turned around by those who have gone. So what I'm saying is, yes, many have gone to the field. We think of Mark and Marty right now, amongst those over there in Ireland and being used over there. And we think of various outreaches going on and will be going on around here, and those we have a part of supporting. And we think of those who go, and sometimes we can maybe think like, wow, there's an extra blessing for them, you know, an extra jewel in the crown and all. And great if there is, and that, you know, there's rewards and promises for that. But what's the Lord maybe teaching us right here tonight through David? We think of those who are sent. But God says he also recognizes the sender. Those who stay home by the stuff. The one who keeps his job here, faithfully serving at his job here, and takes some of that income to support the one who went. God sees that. And there'll be a well done for both. The one who is sent and the one who does the sending. They share alike. He says, not David says, no, we're not, those who stay behind, it's going to be a sharing alike. If God uses you to provide the finances and the prayer support and the encouragement and writing a letter of encouragement, various things, to help someone else go to share the gospel, and someone comes to the Lord through that sharing, God sees those chain of events. And we all share in that. We were all part of the chain that led to that link of that person getting saved. Paul said, how will they hear unless someone goes and tells them? And how will someone go and tell them unless they're sent? We're all a part of that and all share alike in it. But pray and ask God your part. Ask God your part. Don't make light of your part. Well, all I can do is I can't really come out for VBS. All I can do is maybe bring over some craft supplies for them. Maybe I can drop off some snacks. You don't know what that craft is going to do. How many of you went, well, you don't have to answer out loud, but think about maybe when you were a youth and you went to VBS. And you think about maybe something that impacted you, and maybe somehow, maybe you don't even ever thought about it. Maybe it was a craft that drove home a principle that stuck in your heart about what Jesus did for you or something. Or think sometimes of those things, a song or something. Well, there was links that came to that. And I'm just saying, don't make light of anything that you offer to the Lord and let him use, and know that that there's a well done for you in that. The only thing I think, the only shame I see in the body of Christ is when people don't seek out their part, whatever it might be. That's when I think it's sad. When we in the body, because it says every part of the body is needed, whether we're the senders or the sent, whether, you know, we're hands or the arms or the feet or whatever we are, but we all have our part. And that's the only sad thing, I think, is when we don't seek to be whatever part we're supposed to be. But notice he says here, no, we're not gonna play favorites or something. We're all going to share. We're all in this together. We're all in the body of Christ together. We're going to share in the fruits together. We need to move along. Verse 26. Now when David came to Ziklag, he sent, remember he's coming back now, he's got all the spoil, and he comes back home. He says, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil, the enemies of the Lord. It's interesting, David gets home, and apparently there's a great amount of livestock and all, because he gets home and he begins now to send out to the elders of Judah, to these others who have been supportive and all, to his friends. Again, it must have been a pretty good amount of stuff because it says he sends them all a bunch. David sends all these different flocks and all off to various people. I'm not going to go through, you can just read verses 27 through 30 there. It's the naming of the various cities. It won't mean anything to us. When I say he sent some to Eshtemoah, you won't go, oh yeah, Eshtemoah. No, you won't know. And so we're just skip through those ones. But you can read them later if you choose to. But basically he sends it off to all these places. Verse 31, and those who are in Hebron, to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. I mean, those places he hung out, those places where they'd been supportive of him. When he gets this spoil, he doesn't just hoard it, but he sends it off to those who've been helping him along the way. He remembers those who've helped him, and he gives back to them. Let's finish off 1 Samuel tonight. Relatively short chapter, chapter 31. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, as they say in the old radio days. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. Remember, he had been sent home from being in this battle, but now we go back to the battle that he was sent home from, as the Philistines now go to attack Israel. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul. Remember, Saul is the current king, and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. So here at the end of 1 Samuel, at the beginning here of chapter 31, we see the sad end of Saul. We rejoin this battle. It was the battle that David was going to be a part of until he was sent home. But the Philistines now attack, and they obviously accomplish a great victory over the Israelites. Now God had said to Saul, you remember a couple chapters ago when Saul had sought out a medium, he'd gone to the witch of Endor. He had fallen that far away from God that he actually sought out witchcraft to try to get direction. And he asked the witch to bring up Samuel the prophet. Samuel had died, and Samuel the prophet does begin to dialogue with Saul. And Saul says, I don't know what to do. God won't answer me. And Samuel goes, well, if God won't answer you, why are you asking me? And Samuel goes on to say, but you know, Saul, all that's happening is what I said was going to happen to you. But then at the end of that, he threw in this. He said, you know what, Saul? By this time, by tomorrow, you'll be with me. You and your sons are going to be with me. And he said, Israel's going to lose, and you and your sons are going to die. Well, here we see it happen. Just as God had said, so it now comes to pass. The mention of Mount Gilboa, by the way, it says this battle's taking place, they fall slain on Mount Gilboa. Gives us an idea of the range of the battle. Mount Gilboa is up in the northern part of Israel. It's right below the Sea of Galilee, to the west, southwest of there. It's up in the area of Megiddo. Those of you who've been on a trip to Israel, you remember the Valley of Armageddon? We stood on the ruins or the tell of Megiddo, and we looked out over the Valley of Armageddon. That's right near the Mount Gilboa is right in that area. And it shows us that's how far north the battle was. And that's where Saul and his men had gotten driven back to as the battle became more fierce and fierce and the intensity built up. And it tells us in verse 2 that Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua die at that point. Remember, Jonathan was that good, good friend of David and had been a go-for-it kind of guy. And God had taught us so much. Remember, we studied that time when he just went for it and got victory that one time over the Philistines. Well, here we read this time where he and Abinadab and Malchishua now are killed. But not just them, but now Saul. It says Saul is wounded by the archers. The archers hit him and he is severely wounded, it says. And it tells us he falls down and he tells his armor bearer, please take your sword and kill me. Don't let the Philistines come over here and kill me and abuse me. I don't want to die at their hands. You do it. But the armor bearer, he's, you know, afraid to do it. I mean, just like David, you know, you're God's anointed. He's afraid to go kill the king, even though the king's saying, finish me off. But he's afraid to do it. So Saul takes his sword, it says, and falls on it. And it says then that his armor bearer sees that Saul was dead, so he also kills himself. And he dies with Saul. And so Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, all his men died together that same day, it says. Now, just a little preview. We'll see it more next week as we get into 2 Samuel and the story continues here. But we're going to see a young man is going to come and report to David how the battle has gone. He's going to be an Amalekite. And he's going to run and tell David what happened here with Saul and all. And he's going to say, Saul's dead. And we'll read more of it next week, Lord willing. But David's going to go, well, how do you know this? And he's going to say, well, I came across Saul and he was wounded. And at his request, I finished him off. Here it tells us he fell on his sword and died. It tells us his armor bearer sees that he was dead and so kills himself. Next week we'll look at this story that the Amalekite, this Amalekite who's fleeing the battle and all, he's going to say, well, I did it. We'll talk more about that. There's a couple possibilities there. But the bottom line is, Saul is dead. So verse 7 we read, and when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. So it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shin. So, the battle's gone poorly. The other Israelites cross the valley on the other side of the Jordan. They hear this and they flee their cities. The Philistines move in and begin to occupy the land. As often is the case in battle, they go out to gather their spoils and, you know, to get swords and stuff that have been left behind or from those they've killed in all the battle. And they come across Saul and his sons. And of course, this is a great victory, and the Philistines believe for them, and they want to display this. So they cut off the head of Saul, and they take off his armor, and they send around the word that they have done this and gotten this victory. And it says the armor is placed in the temple of the Ashtoreth, and they fasten his body to the wall of Beth Shin. When you have an opportunity, if God should provide for you to go to Israel, of the many sites you'll want to go visit, I encourage you strongly to go visit Beth Shin. Very magnificent ruins there. First, there's a large tell. Tells are areas of built-up land where they've built city after city that would get destroyed. They build another one on top of it, and pretty soon you have a big mound, but it's actually often made up of the ruins of city after city. Well, around that, there's a mound, big mound there, big tell at Beth Shin. Well, around there are their extensive ruins of later developed by the Romans and all. A big amphitheater and very interesting, just the bathhouse these large columns, very probably the most extensive ruins that I've had the privilege to go see over there, and you'll want to go see that. But you can make your way up a very kind of a steep little trail there, and you go up to the top of the tell at Beth Shin, and there's still some ruins on the top of that tell where the more original village and the original city was there. And it tells us that it's that in that place that they took the body of Saul and hung his body on the walls there of Beth Shin to display to everybody their great victory.
But now it tells us in verse 11, now when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, when they heard that they beheaded him and they got his body hanging on the wall over there at Beth Shean, it says, all the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth Shean, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So these valiant men at Jabesh Gilead, they've lost, you know, and the Israelites have lost, but they hear what they've done to Saul's body, and they are brave enough and valiant enough that they hear this. They travel all night, they make their way to Beth Shean, they get into the city, and they get the bodies from off the wall at Beth Shean, and they bring them back to Jabesh Gilead. And it says they cremate them there, and then they take the bones that are left after the cremation and bury them under this tree here at Jabesh. As a sidelight, just in case you ever wonder, I have never found anywhere in Scripture where it says cremation is wrong. If you ever, you know, sometimes people come to me and they wonder, well, you know, a relative or a friend has died and we're wondering about this, and, you know, would the Lord have us have a, what we, you know, bury the body or have a cremation and all? It's a tent. It's simply a tent. And the person who used to live in that tent has moved out. As one commentator that I heard say, all cremation does is it does to the body in about 30 seconds what it takes 30 years for the earth to do to it. Either way, the body goes dust to dust, ash to ash. You know, it just goes back. So what I'm saying is, in case you've ever wondered, Scripture does not say a right or wrong way to get rid of that old tent you used to live in. But now we've come to the end of 1 Samuel, and thus ends the life of Saul on this earth. And he was the man of Israel's first king. He was a man who had such potential, such promise. God had used Samuel to go and point out and anoint and all this calling that God had placed upon Saul. And he was a man of such potential, and yet winds up with such a sad ending. Because he just wouldn't obey God. He point blank rejected the word of the Lord. He wouldn't obey. So it gets to the point where God says, then okay, Saul, I rejected you as king. And he hung on for all that time. You know, he just became such a paranoid, angry, jealous, fearful man. Trying to hang on to this throne, going more and more downhill. It's a sad story. But I hope we've seen there are important lessons for us. Because in the end, you have a contrast. You have the man who is completely about himself, about his own agenda, as contrasted to David, the man after God's heart. Our goal in all this is to be people after God's own heart. Next week, Lord willing, we dive into 2 Samuel as David now first learns of Saul's death and David is anointed king over the house of Judah. I invite you to join with us as we travel through the Bible together. Let's stand. There'll be prayer partners available.